We had different radio philosophies. She was a radio personality who wound up at a hip-hop station, and I was a hip-hop kid who wound up doing radio. Two very different types of human beings. But ultimately, she was great at being Wendy, and all I ever wanted to do was be great at being me. Again, I ask her if she has an issue with me. Again, she blows me off. No, no, it's fine. I didn't even say anything. Whatever. No, seriously, Wendy. We worked together. We had to see each other every day. I'm looking at you in your face and asking you to please stop making this uncomfortable. She finally hears me. Well, that's what she says. I hear you. I'm sorry. I'll stop. And she did. For a few weeks. Then the bitch did it again. I was driving to work and had the radio on, and I heard her say something about my relationship. No mistaking that when Wendy said, I'm not the one dating a rapper up here. Ugh. If I was, maybe I would like that song. Just catty dumb shit like that. It was so unnecessary and weird. And now I gotta walk into work and be cordial again? Nope. I had to try a different approach. The time had come to go to management. Listen, I began, not mincing my words. I gotta see this woman every day and I'm uncomfortable. You gotta talk to her or we're gonna have a problem. For many other reasons, management had their own issues with Wendy. Steve Smith assured me, I'll talk to her. And it worked. For a few weeks. And then again, she said something catty about my relationship with Tip. What the fuck? So I'm going into the station that day and I'm like, Wendy, do me a favor. Don't talk about me at all. Because now it's a problem. I started getting stern about it. Seriously, don't do it. I gotta see you every day. I don't want a problem with you. I hear you. I see you. Stop. She actually looked me in the eye this time and said, okay, fine. I get it. No problem. She added, Angie, I'm sorry. I'll stop. Finally, she didn't deny it. All right, cool. Finally, we got it out. It's gonna fucking stop. I couldn't wait to get it all behind me. A couple of days later, I'm at Margarita's house. My friend from Miami, who was now living in Queens after landing a job at a record label. And we're hanging out and talking shit when I get a strange call. One of the record reps is calling to ask, yo, have you seen Wendy's website? I haven't. You should go check it out. Wendy had launched a website. At this point, websites weren't that big of a deal because not everybody was online yet and personal websites had just started. It was almost unheard of. So I go to her website and it says, one of my coworkers is dating Q-Tip from a tribe called Quest. Well, I guess some women like men who like men. Everybody was gay to Wendy. Every rapper you could think of in that era, I had heard Wendy Williams call them gay. Not one or two, like every one of them. She was all about the gay rapper. That was her thing. And she was running with it. Are you fucking kidding me? We just had a conversation about this. I'm on fire. And I immediately called to tell Tip. Whatever, he says, she's crazy. I wasn't even trying to hear him. Fuck that, I insist. I worked too hard for too long to let this lady keep disrespecting me. I'm gonna deal with her tomorrow. This is going to stop. I woke up the next morning as infuriated as the night before and headed into work early to confront her. As I approached the station, I could feel my anger building. I couldn't focus on anything else and I couldn't shake it. The crazy thing is that normally I never confront anyone when I'm too emotional or angry. I try to be smarter than that. It's impossible to operate from a sensible place when you're that worked up. I knew it could lead to a bad situation, but at this point she had pushed me into a corner. As I got into the elevator, I began to regain some of my senses and talk myself off the ledge. You know what? You're being crazy. You're not in high school. It's just Wendy. This is her shtick. This is what she does. Don't bring yourself down to her level. You're not going to do anything to her. That would be dumb. There has to be another way to work this out. I was almost calm when I stepped off the elevator and started making my way to the studio area. Then I saw Wendy. She was prancing to the bathroom with her big weave bouncing all over the place like she didn't have a care in the world. Hey, Angie. And man, there was something about the way she said my name that made my fucking blood boil. It was so phony and condescending. The whole time she was in the bathroom, I was right outside of the ladies' room waiting, pacing. Then Wendy comes out of the bathroom and I'm standing right there. She stops quick. Didn't I tell you to leave me the fuck alone? What are you talking about? Wendy, I told you to leave me the fuck alone. She rolls her eyes. Ugh. And I lost my fucking mind. Before I knew it, I was swinging at her. It was a quick scuffle. It took only a few seconds for me to realize that she wasn't really hitting me back. She was just trying to get me off of her. I think she was just stunned. Nobody got hurt or anything like that. And then Skeletor, her board op at the time, came running out of the studio shouting, "Girls, girls, what's going on? Angie, stop." By that point, Wendy began yelling, "What is wrong with you?" She grabbed the mop that had been leaning against the wall outside of the bathroom and just stood there with it like she wanted to have some sort of sword fight or something. It was actually kind of funny even in that moment. I asked, "What are you going to do with that, Wendy?" She said nothing. Calmly, I asked, "No, seriously, what are you going to do with that?" She put it down and stormed back into the studio. I calmly walked back to the programming area into my music director, Tracy Cloherty's office. "I just want you to know before anyone tells you that I just put my hands on Wendy." Tracy bounced right up out of her chair. "What?" she said. "Sit down. Are you crazy? Stay right there." And she went storming out of the studio. I must have lasted 4 seconds sitting there thinking, I tried to handle it the nice, positive, right way multiple times. As I sat there recapping in my head, I started to get all fired up again. She put me in the fucking corner, man. So I storm out of Tracy's office and follow her to the studio. I bust in and she's already in conversation with Wendy. They both turn around and just look at me. They both have this glare in their eye like, oh my God, what is she gonna do? Why is she here? Tracy says, "Angie, get out of here right now." I pause and look at Wendy, who is visibly shaken. And she lets out an erratic, "You're crazy!" Me. I'm the crazy one. I could tell by the seriousness on Tracy's face that we were done here. So I went back to her office and waited for her to come back. This was another time my career could have been over before I even hit afternoons. I could have been fired. By the way, I should have been fired. Instead, I got suspended. And so did she. The Daily News ran with the headline, "Angie Martinez pounces on Wendy Williams." To this day, I don't know what Wendy really felt, if she was mad or embarrassed or just shocked. When she went on the radio the next day, she stated, "For the record, nobody hit anybody. Nobody punched anybody." People had warned me that there might be a lawsuit, but once she said that, I was relieved. Oh, great. I don't have to worry about anything there. Then a divide happened. Wendy had always been an outsider at the station. She would bring ratings, but her personality was not that of a team player. And as an outsider, she'd caused resentment in the past, and people started feeling comfortable enough to voice it. Flex got on the radio and read the article, treating it as if it was funny. "She pounced! Ha!" He was laughing at Wendy on the air. This was a co-worker still. He shouldn't have done that, but Flex was Flex, and he knew that people would eat the story up. The truth is that if it wasn't me, it was going to be somebody else. She was disrespectful to so many people all the time. And this may sound crazy, but I actually believe that it was a good thing it was me because I wasn't somebody who really wanted to hurt her. I was just trying to defend myself. I thought maybe I saved her from someone else feeling they needed to run up on her. Someone who actually could have hurt her. Yes, at the time, I actually believed that it was for an all-around good cause. I for sure got a few thank you notes. My mother, who knew the world of radio as well as anyone, even if she didn't know the day-to-day dynamics at HOT, asked me the following night, "Well, what really happened?" "Well, you know, I just kind of pushed her." I shrugged, trying to downplay what happened. "Really?" she said. "Because the paper says you pounced on her." My mother was concerned and I was embarrassed. A few days later, she came to me and said, "You know what one of my colleagues said?" "What?" "You know the thing with Wendy?" my mother began, and then paused, careful and thoughtful with her words, as always, as she continued. "As much as it's the wrong thing to do to ever put your hand on someone, especially at work, it does set a precedent that you are not somebody that can be pushed around." And my mother, by the way, is the queen of doing everything by the book. She never wants to offend anybody, She never wants to do anything illegal. You know, if she owes you $4.07, here is your $4.05, $4.06, $4.07. She is by the book, Shirley. So for her to understand and say, in the big picture, down the road in your life and your career, at least people will know you are not somebody that will allow someone else to push them around. That was her way of saying, I trust your judgment and I support you. A few weeks passed, and when they brought me back from my suspension, that's when the conversation happened. I really should have been fired, but everybody there was already tired of Wendy because there were a lot of problems with her. She wasn't happy there either. And I think they were looking for a reason to get rid of her as it was. Listen, we know Wendy's a pain in the ass, Steve said. We'd love to get rid of her, but the problem is if we did that, you have to do afternoon drive. I never wanted to do afternoon drive. I loved being on air at night. I loved the freedom. I loved the artists. I loved being able to go out after, and I didn't want to do afternoon drive. To me, that was corny. I mean, I was on in the nights when I could be edgy. Plus, I was still young and still wanted to be in the streets. Steve may have understood that I didn't want to do that, but he put it to me in no uncertain terms, saying, listen, if you don't do afternoon drive, I cannot let Wendy go. I don't have anyone else strong enough to take that slot. The only way I can let her go is if you take it. After talking to Flex and Ed and a few others at the station, I agreed. I would take one for the team. So now, not only am I moving into a time slot that I don't want, but the thing about Wendy Williams is that she is super talented and amazing at what she does. I don't do what she does. And I was scared as shit. And soon the story was everywhere. Dueling DJs, Friday, October 24th, 1997. After getting into a shoving match with fellow Hot 97 DJ Wendy Williams, it must be sweet to Angie Martinez to have taken over Williams' drive time slot the last 2 weeks. Despite her high ratings, the trash-talking Williams has been gone from the station for 3 weeks, and management ain't saying whether it's permanent. The Daily News headlines continued throughout October 1997, and Wendy's listeners were wondering if she was gone for good. And now that I was on afternoons, but no official announcement had been made, Wendy's listeners became most unfriendly. I used to get threatening faxes. It wasn't texts or emails or tweets. It was faxes that said things like, bitch, get off the radio. I'll break your jaw. It was awful, and it made me insecure. Worse, the newspaper reported that Wendy's fans had other plans, too. Fans rally and cry. Where's Wendy? Friday, October 31st, 1997. Fans of WQHT afternoon DJ Wendy Williams, who has been off the air for almost a month with no official explanation, are planning a protest rally at the station Monday to ask why. The rally is planned at Hot 97 Studios at 395 Hudson Street, 2 to 4 p.m. Station officials couldn't be reached yesterday for comment on Williams' status. She is aware of Monday's rally, but it isn't known if she will attend. Williams was reportedly involved in a heated argument at the station a month ago with sister DJ Angie Martinez. They were planning a rally? A fucking rally. How had my charmed radio life been turned upside down? I was somebody who loved what I did and tried to have a voice that mattered to my listeners and had never had any aspirations or claims on anyone else's arena. All of a sudden, everyone is putting the pressure on, saying, well, you're filling the shoes of Wendy. Can you get her numbers? Can you fill her spot? Can you deal with this type of heat on you? It was the first time people were nasty to me. Apparently, I had to develop a much thicker skin. You just keep pushing. You can't quit. You just keep showing up every day. I sucked for a while because I was off balance. What I had been doing for so long at night didn't work in the afternoon. Not surprisingly, at first, I couldn't deliver. But I couldn't let myself believe that would be forever. So I just had to keep going. Bit by bit, I begin to get the difference. In the afternoon, you have to be a little quicker with it. Nighttime, I could be like, who's ordering chicken? We could talk about that for 8 minutes, and it was entertaining. In the middle of the day, when people are at work, that's going to lose the audience. That challenge is that you have to develop a whole different timing. And I had to get beat the fuck up for a while. From what I heard later on, I almost didn't make it. Blundering along, I think the part that hurt most was feeling so alone. Management started to wonder if they had made a mistake. And Flex was still telling labels that guests had to come to his show first. He was taking all the exclusives. I was drowning. Finally, I called Flex and said, I want to talk to you. Our relationship had become flimsy. We barely talked anymore. But really, I had no one else to turn to. I couldn't do this alone, and I needed him. It was a tough call for me to make, and for weeks he blew me off, with one excuse or another. At last he agreed that I'd come to meet him in his office and we'd go somewhere for lunch. We jumped into one of his muscle cars and headed out for something to eat. On the way, I started in, explaining, look, you don't understand how hard it is for me out here. I'm trying to navigate my way through this shit by myself. I don't know what to do a lot of the times. I couldn't believe how upset I allowed myself to be, pouring it all out. Even this Wendy thing. I don't want to do afternoons. I'm taking it for the team. She had to go, you all agreed, and now I don't feel like I'm getting support from anybody. I don't even know what happened to us. Like, you're talking shit? And in the middle of what I'm saying, I start crying, bawling like a little girl, sniffling and trying to catch my breath. Flex looked so shaken and confused. You see, Flex is the type that thrives off competition and is motivated by a proverbial enemy. So I think once I wasn't, in his mind, on his team anymore, he just put me in the competition box and treated me as such. But in that moment, I think he realized that not only was I not his enemy, but that I actually loved him and needed him. And in that moment, something changed. Flex looked over and smiled his great smile. It's all right, Ange. You know, you did the right thing, he said. You're going to be great. Don't worry. From that day on, Flex has probably been the most important person in my radio career. He has defended me when I didn't ask him to, and he was a bully for me during a lot of crazy times. I know I wouldn't have been on the air without him, but I also don't think I would have survived some of those tough periods had we not had the 1-2 punch of Flex and Ange. We lit those fires when those fires needed to be lit. Once we established trust with each other, then it was like we were unstoppable. That conversation was a defining moment, maybe for both of us. Flex and I became like the mother and father of the whole station. He could do the dirty work, playing the power politics and pushing his weight when it had to be done, and he left me a lane where I didn't have to. I didn't want to do dirty work. I didn't want to argue with people. I just wanted to be gracious and boost morale and hopefully motivate. Flex came through time and again. He had been my friend, my confidant, my mentor, my guy. That's not to say he hasn't pissed me off over the years, but he pissed me off in the way a family member would piss you off. Like, I'm going to call you and tell you, what the fuck did you do that for? We disagreed plenty of times, but even when we did, there was not ever a doubt about his loyalty or our friendship. That adjustment to the new time slot took some time, and eventually I found a rhythm. Eventually, I found my voice in the afternoons. The lesson was a first for me. The fact that shit ain't always sweet. People are not always gonna like you. When I look back at the past, I had to say to myself, of course, you found your niche and got real comfortable and people liked you and you were grateful for it, but you also somewhat took it for granted. That was back in once upon a time when you could just do what you love and it's all gonna be sweet. And now you've moved on, and that's not the case anymore. It was no more Battle of the Beats, which I missed. Now I was doing the high five at 4 instead of the high five at 9. Now my interviews had to be a lot quicker. It was a tough adjustment, but, you know, I found my way. Wendy found hers as well. I watch her TV talk show sometimes, and she has really mastered her lane. I find myself watching and laughing out loud. I don't have any ill feelings towards her. When I think about what happened, I understand that she was doing her, and she didn't care who she offended. And I was fighting for myself. I was very protective of my personal relationships, and I felt violated in a place where I shouldn't ever have to feel violated. And so what do you do when you're in a corner? Sometimes you have to fight back. As dramatic as the episode was, it was only a moment in time. I haven't seen her since. Chapter 8. Through the Fire. Half asleep. Early on the first Saturday of February 1998, I'm at Tip's house in Inglewood, New Jersey, and I hear him banging around and making noise like he's trying to wake me up on purpose. We had been fighting a lot that week, and the night before, I got so pissed off that I grabbed my pillow and went to sleep by myself in the other room. So I hear him walking around and shaking the house. My blurry thoughts are, why is he being so loud? Is he just trying to be a dick? Because I slept in the guest room? I was so sleepy and so annoyed. That's when he burst into the room. Get up! What? Why? You don't smell the smoke? There's a fire in the house! I jump up. What? Where? I think it's in the studio. Get dressed. We gotta get out of here. While he runs downstairs to see what's happening and to try to find the extinguisher, I bolt into his room to grab some shorts and slippers. By the time I get back to the staircase, the flames are there, climbing up the sides and quickly building at the bottom. Tip! I scream. He comes running around to the bottom of the stairs trying to beat the flames with a blanket. Come on! He calls me from the bottom where I could barely see him. Just run down fast. I got you. I was terrified. I looked around and quickly assessed my options. I can't do it. I'm just going to jump from the balcony. I'm not sure why I thought the 20-foot jump from the balcony was a better option than running through the flames, but that was my plan. Come on, he yelled. I can't do it, Tip. I'm scared. I'm just going to... Before I could finish, Tip threw the blanket over his head and ran up the stairs to grab me. He covered me with the blanket, grabbed my hand and said, keep your head down and don't stop. And together we ran down the stairs and out of the house. Tip's road manager and friend Light was with us, and the three of us just stood there, covered in soot, and watched the house burn down. For what felt like hours, we watched it all burn. And I mean everything. Clothes, photos, unreleased music, equipment, and probably the most painful to Tip, his entire beloved record collection. Ruined. If you know anything about Q-Tip, you'd know these albums were not just a typical record collection. This was his life. This is what got him out of the hood. He spent countless days finding exclusives and rare vinyl, and then hours each day listening to the nuances of these albums, trying to rework them. I mean, it was devastating, and we were all numb. Ali Shaheed Muhammad, his longtime friend and collaborator from Tribe, came over soon after, and I remember watching the two of them standing over the melted vinyl. It was so brutal. We took a photo of the moment and tried to keep perspective in the spirit of, these are only material things. Let us be grateful to be alive. We posed and did our best B-boy stance. Years later, when I came across the photos, it was obvious we weren't fooling anyone. We did do the poses, but in our eyes, there was nothing but sadness. We tried to give ourselves a sense that life would go on and it was good to be alive, so we decided to leave the scene for some pancakes. There we were, Light, Q-Tip, Ali, and me at the IHOP in Inglewood, New Jersey, covered in soot and reeking of smoke and fire. It was such a sad day. Tip and I made it out of the fire, but our relationship, already strained, had new challenges. He had just converted to Islam, and in finding his path, he became exacting in his beliefs. Though I made an effort to read the Quran and get as familiar as I could with the religion, that was not my path. It wasn't as if the fire caused the breakup, but I think when you go through any kind of life-threatening ordeal, it forces you to take stock of your life and figure out what's important. We both saw that our lives were in different places, and as much as we loved each other, Tip couldn't compromise what he saw for his future, and I couldn't compromise mine. Ultimately, it didn't work, but I adore him, and we are still great friends to this day. That year delivered huge hip-hop albums, including Big Pun's Capital Punishment, making him the first Latin rapper to ever go platinum. This was such a big deal because not only was he Latino, but this was real hip-hop, and he was dope. Latinos were proud. Big Pun was signed to Fat Joe's newly formed Terror Squad, along with Cuban Link, Prospect, Armageddon, and Triple Sace. Some of my favorite memories of this era are hanging out with Big Pun and Fat Joe up at Jimmy's in the Bronx. Fat Joe's then-girlfriend and future wife, Lorena, would become one of my closest friends. She is the definition of a rider. The type of friend you want to go to war with or commit a crime with because you know she'll have your back till the end. I'd known Joe for a lot of years at this point, and we also developed a friendship. Fat Joe, a big Puerto Rican with an even bigger presence, could tell a story like nobody else, always entertaining and extremely likable. There was a certain innate camaraderie that I had with him, being authentically part of the culture and also Latino and from New York. As Joe's career grew, he went from being a solo artist to the leader of the Terror Squad. Pun was another Puerto Rican from the Bronx and a notorious prankster with a quirky sense of humor. The kind of humor where you weren't sure if he was hilarious or if you should be offended. There was this one time when Big Pun came to my show and brought me weed cookies. "Have one," Pun said with a twinkle in his eye. Though I smoked weed, I'd never eaten it before, so I didn't know what the difference was. I tried a cookie, and it had no effect. "I don't feel anything," I told him. 10 minutes pass, still nothing. 15 minutes later, nothing. "Have more," Pun said, because he's a fucking asshole. "Eat more." Whatever. I didn't really want to eat more, but he was relentless. So I ate a shitload of cookies. And when those things kicked in, Pun had already left. And I thought I was going to die. Actually die. "Call 911. Take me to the hospital. I'm poisoned," I screamed to my producer, Patty Duke. As I was just learning, the thing about weed cookies is that it's not the same type of high as when you smoke. When you smoke, you chill. This was crazy aggressive and so nauseating that I started to throw up as my head spun, telling me one thing. "I'm going to die. Patty, I need you to call 911. "I can't call 911. Patty reminded me that I still had an hour left of my show to do. He said if I call 911, everyone is going to know that something happened to you. The bosses are going to ask what happened. And we're going to have to tell them that you were eating weed cookies on the air with Pun. We can't call an ambulance." "Well, I'll take myself to the hospital then," I stormed out. I never made it to the emergency room, but instead had to be driven home where I then slept it off. Never again. No weed cookies, brownies, or gummy bears for me, thanks. That episode aside, I was so happy for Big Pun when his album went platinum, and when he and Fat Joe showed the industry that there was much more to come from Latin hip-hop artists. New voices were coming into their own from other corners, and overall, the players in the game were a more diverse cast of characters than ever. In 1998, Outkast's Equemini put a spotlight on hip-hop coming out of the South. It was a big time for super crews like the Fugees, Murder, Inc., Rough Riders, and Shady Aftermath. As Y2K came into view, it was a done deal just how wrong the people were who said that hip-hop was only a phase and it wouldn't last. This was not a bad time to be in the middle of it all, and I swung into high gear on my show in the afternoons, pulling out all the stops. The pace was crazier than ever. On top of that, I was single and caught up even more in the fast life. Hosting parties, hosting mixtapes, hanging out and having fun, but always working and always running. After the split with Tip, I'd moved to a new apartment on Prospect Avenue in Hackensack, New Jersey, which was one of those neighborhoods where you would run into rappers at the supermarket. Lots of music industry, new money folks living in high-rise luxury buildings. That was us. Mike Kaiser from Def Jam lived up the block. And either I or someone else would host a night of playing spades or extremely intense Monopoly games with people like Irv Gotti and Ja Rule joining in. When my girlfriend Liani got engaged, her bachelorette party was at my crib. And since hosting was my thing, I started to have taco nights on the regular. I mean, that apartment brought me so much fun. Well, that is until... yep, it happened again. Eviction notice on the door. Padlock on the doorknob. Me standing there in horror again. What is wrong with me? I didn't think my rent was that late. Now, in addition to the shock and embarrassment that I felt the last time this had happened, I was also so mad at myself. At this point, I'm 27 years old, and this shit is not cute. Nikki was in between apartments and had been staying with me at the time, so now not only was I homeless, but I had made my best friend homeless too. All because my dumbass wants to live check to check, drive Benzes, and pay my bills whenever I got around to it. Just dumb, irresponsible shit. The first night, Nikki and I stayed at Margarita's house. Then we went to a hotel. At that point, I thought hard about what it was going to take to get back into the crib and never let anything like this happen ever, ever again. The immediate goal was to figure out how to pay the $6,000 in back rent and get back into the apartment. The problem was I didn't have it. I was only able to scrape together 3 of the 6. Nikki shrugged. "Why don't you call Tip?" Of course I knew he would say yes and bail me out, but I couldn't. My pride wouldn't let me. Instead, I called my friend Mary. Mary J. Blige. God, there are no words for how I love that woman. She is one of the most authentic people I know. Mary is all heart. Not an easy thing to be, by the way. It is the reason she is able to make the music she has made and touch the lives she has touched. Come get me now, I'm in the studio, were the first words out of her mouth when I told her what had happened. Are you sure? Girl, bring your ass over here. She was going to lend me the money. When we arrived at the studio, it was almost midnight. Mary ran downstairs and hopped in the back of Nikki's 94 Honda Accord as we drove off to find an open check cashing spot. I have no idea why Mary happened to have an uncashed check in her purse at that moment, but she did. We tried a few places, but they were all closed. At that point, I'm sitting in the passenger seat as Nikki drives, and I look back to see a serious expression on Mary's face as she says, Nikki, pull over. We gotta pray on this. I don't remember the exact prayer, but I do remember Mary intensely rebuking the situation and asking God to spare me from these type of problems. Right after that, we found a 24-hour check cashing place in Midtown. With no concern about any of the people who recognized her in there, Mary got the cash, handed me the $3,000, no questions asked. We got back into the apartment the next day. And I don't know if it was Mary's prayer session in the back of the Accord or my vow to never, ever let this happen again. But after that, I started to get my shit together. It wasn't overnight, but I got serious about how I chose to support the lifestyle of being a grown-up in my late 20s. Sometimes you go through the fire of an embarrassing eviction, like I had the first time, and you just don't get the lesson. Or you do learn it, but you get so caught up in other demands that it loses its staying power. So you have to get through it again. And even though nothing disastrous happened in the end, twice was enough to give me a crash course in keeping a better eye on how I earned, spent, and saved money. And thank God I did start to do that. Because after all that talk about me recording an album of my own, Sylvia Rhone at Elektra Records actually made me an offer. The deal was for more than $100,000 to go into the studio and record an album. Yep. A fucking $100,000 advance check for me as an artist in my own right. And as icing on the cake, Warner Brothers gave me a publishing deal for even more than that. Now remember, at this point, I had done 8 bars on the Ladies Night remix and had written a couple of verses for Doo-Wop and Tony Touch mixtapes. Nothing more than trying it out, trying to learn, putting my toe in the water. But that was it. I had absolutely no clue on how to even begin to make an album. But again, here I was with an opportunity that I sure as hell was going to embrace, as I would encourage anybody in my position to do. You show up and you go for it all the way. And then you sink or swim. Chapter 9, Up Close and Personal. My career as a solo artist got off to a rocky start. It was a lot more sinking than swimming from the get-go. I booked a few sessions and paid a few producers to come in and sit with me and try out a few things. That did not go well. Then the label sent me to Virginia to work with the Neptunes. The Neptunes were a production team made up by Chad Hugo and Pharrell Williams. Yes, that Pharrell. The future singer of Happy, Judge on The Voice, and BBC Mogul. And they were on fire at the time, producing everybody from Mystical with hits coming like Shake Your Ass and Danger to Jay-Z on The City Is Mine from earlier and I Just Want to Love You around this period. They produced hits for artists like The Lox and had a slate of new stuff coming up with Lil' Kim and Shine. The list went on and on. What was I doing there? My self-doubts kicked in as soon as I got to Virginia Beach and tried to settle in at some damp hotel that felt dark and lonely. Maybe it wasn't really that bad, but I was so out of my element, and I was nervous as shit. Since the Neptunes were so in demand, they had several projects going at once, and I was told to just stay put until they were ready for me. Time passed way too slowly until finally the label rep called to say, hey, your car's going to pick you up and bring you to the studio around 10 p.m. The Neptunes are finishing up with Khalees. Then they'll start with you. Sure enough, the car came and got me to the studio. As I walked in, music was blasting, playing a beat that sounded dope as shit. Pharrell stood there over the boards, bopping his head while everyone in the room did the same. He looked up and saw me and came right over and gave me a hug. Yo, that's dope, right? It turned out to be Ray J's Wait a Minute. Then he gestured to the other room, saying, come on, let's go in there and talk. I'd met Pharrell a few times and he had been a guest on my show, but the two of us had never really hung out. And I wasn't certain why he even agreed to work with me. As we sat down, he was super flattering, explaining that he was a fan of me on the radio and he was totally open to hearing my ideas. The problem was, I had no ideas. Like, none. Okay, no worries. Let's just vibe and see what happens. For the next 2 days, I was a guest in the Neptune's creative genius world. I watched them make beats and do their wizardry, tweaking other people's songs. They played me raw audio of an old Dirty Bastard session where he spit like 1,000 bars of bizarre drug-induced brilliance. At one point that second day, when we all got hungry, Pharrell and I ventured out on a Fuddruckers run to get some food. On the way, we listened to everything from some unreleased Khalees to Steely Dan. He put me onto this song called Three Roses by the 70s rock group America that I love to this day. He pointed out how ill the guitar change in that song was and played it for me like 5 times in a row to ensure that I fully understood. I love people who love what they do. How could you not be inspired by that? Back to the studio, I was fed, we vibed, I was inspired, and then Pharrell uttered the 5 words I had been dreading for 2 days. You ready to get started? Well, here goes nothing. Let's do it. I was thinking something like this, he said, and plays me a beat called Them Things. You got something for this? He asked. Nah, not yet, but that's dope, I said. That was my best attempt at playing it cool. He told me to take it to the other room and sit with it for a little while, so I did. For 4 hours. And nothing. I mean, nothing. Not a verse, a hook, a bar, nothing. I was in a full tilt panic. I couldn't handle that much pressure, and now I was cracking in front of everyone. Pharrell, God bless his soul, was cool about it. He offered to have Pusha T and Malice from his new group, The Clips, help me. But as dope as they were rapping about drug life. And as desperate as I was for help, pushing weight from state to state was not going to fly. I asked Pharrell if I could take the beat home with me to New York and spend some time with it on my own. He agreed. So I went back to New York, feeling defeated and with a full understanding that I was in way over my head. That's when I went looking for Salam. Salam, I can't do this. Sure you can, Billy. Salam and I call each other Billy. No clue why or when it started, but it's our thing. Get all the stuff you've done so far and meet me at my studio, he said. We will figure this out. Whatever had caused me to freeze up started to thaw. Salam and I talked about some of the things I wanted to say, and he asked me what was going on in my life. Then he suggested we go outside and jump in my car so he could hear what I had in my CD changer. The answer was there all the time. The minute we hit play and heard, Suavemente, besame, te quiero sentir tus labios, besándome otra vez. Of course, Suavemente by Elvis Crespo was my shit. Salam said, okay, we'll do a hip-hop version of this. Let's call Clef. Now that Clef and the Fugees were bona fide superstars and Salam had been an instrumental part of that, getting Clef on the phone was easy. That was the magic moment. From there, I reached out to others who were artists and friends to help as well. At this point in my career, my relationships were solid, so when I asked the artists to come, they just all showed up. It really was humbling. Not to mention that ultimately, I'm a fan. So to have the opportunity to be in the studio with most of them was like a kid getting to toss the ball around with his favorite baseball player. Pretty fucking cool. It was everyone from Snoop Dogg, Jay-Z, Mary J. Blige, Jadakiss, Busta Rhymes, Styles P, and La India, to Q-Tip, Kool G Rap, Little Mo, Beanie Siegel, and of course, Fat Joe, Cuban Link, and the rest of the Terror Squad. Well, most of the Terror Squad. Sadly, in early 2000, a few months before I even started recording my album, Big Pun had passed after suffering a massive heart attack. He was so talented, so funny, and irreverent, and had that larger-than-life persona. Even though he was a big guy, he seemed like he could just weather anything. Or maybe it was just that he was so young, only 28 at the time, that it felt so incomprehensible. One of my favorite radio drops ever was made by Pun. Angie, come downstairs. The pump is open. I included it on the album. He was definitely with us in spirit. My schedule was pretty insane. I would do my show from 3 to 7 p.m. and then be at Salam's studio till the morning. As all-consuming as it was, I knew that if nothing else, this experience would make me a better radio personality. From that point on, whenever an artist came to my show with their new album, I would have a much more developed understanding of what it took to make that album. Granted, that still put me in the position of knowing that there were people out there sharpening their knives, ready to put me on the chopping block of extreme criticism. And I was probably my own toughest critic. Oh my God, I would write a verse and in my head it sounded good. Then I would get in the booth and hate the fact that I was not seasoned enough to execute it in the way I heard it in my head. I would do it 100 times over and over and over. I want to do it again. I want to do it again. I want to do it again. Why is it so fucking hard? God bless the poor sound engineer, Gary, who would sit there with me all night, redoing every verse. All that pressure aside, however, getting to do the album led to some truly great times. Man, lots of weed, takeout food from the Jamaican spot, jokes for days, and an opportunity to make music with my friends. The lesson to be learned was that, rather than being so hard on myself, I should have let that moment be what it was. Sometimes you have to get past the fears and insecurities that may actually hold you back from being great or from truly experiencing something the way it was meant to be experienced. Since then, I've tried to do that more just by being in the moment. Maybe as my imaginary mentor, Oprah, could have told me. In any case, I finished. I made a motherfucking album. When the decision was made to hold the album release party at Jimmy's Bronx Cafe, I was psyched. After years of attending and hosting countless album release parties for other people, I was actually having my own. And I couldn't think of anywhere that would be more perfect than the birthplace of hip-hop, the Bronx. When I pulled up that night, I saw a billboard with my picture and album cover on the side of this big building, so you could see it from the highway that runs by. But that night was far from perfect. Before the party started, I'd gotten wind that Cuban Link had asked Fat Joe to be released from his Terror Squad contract. Apparently, Cuban was unhappy that his own solo album release had been delayed. The truth was that, with Big Pun gone, the Terror Squad had been falling apart. The last thing I expected was to have the tension spill out at my party, where Joe and Cuban and everyone else was there to show me love. But that's exactly what happened. What wasn't clear was who exactly started the fight. The only clarity I had was that I was downstairs feeling pissed off that they were upstairs fighting. Come on, I felt like telling them. If you want to fight, go somewhere else and fight. There were different versions of what happened next. I don't know what happened, but all I know is that the fight ended with Cuban Link getting his face sliced open by a blade. The night went down as one of those reminders that there was a dark side to this journey I was on. Behind the mic, on the radio, or in the studio, there was lots of drama, yet it was more contained. But the ride wasn't only about those highlights. There were also some lowlights. People fighting, getting stabbed, and shot. The violence and dysfunction. Although the release party hadn't gone as planned, when we released the album, it debuted at number 7 on Billboard's top R&B hip-hop album rankings. Buoyed by lots of play for the 3 singles, Mi Amor, Them Things, and Coast to Coast, Suavemente. Now that I had to build from there and needed a manager, I turned to my friend Sean Pecas. We call him Pecas because he had a face full of freckles. And Pecas means freckles in Spanish. By this point, Peck and I had known each other for years. He did rap promotions at G Street Records back in the day, helped break Peter Guns and Lord Tariq, and was now working at Arista. I had no reason to think that Peck would be a good manager, but I trusted him. I felt connected to him. And I liked the way he carried himself and treated people. That was good enough for me. He agreed. He then hired Yvette Davila to be my road manager. The 3 of us quickly became a family. Pecas and I would fight like brother and sister, and Yvette would have to intervene. Peck and Yvette would bump heads, and I'd have to jump in and tell them to knock it off. All that said, we trusted each other, and I knew they had my back. And I needed it. I had never in my life worked so hard. My radio show was in full gear, and now somehow I was going to have to hit the road to promote this album. Traveling across the country was eye-opening. Whether I was doing in-store signings or club appearances in major markets or small towns, the first thing that really struck me was the separation of Blacks and Latinos. In New York, we all grew up together in the same neighborhoods. We liked the same hip-hop. There was no disconnect. Out on the road, not every town was like that. I'd hear questions like, "What are you, Mexican?" Somebody asked me once if I was related to Lisa Lisa. I quickly realized that being a young Latin girl at a hip-hop club wasn't as common everywhere else. That was one more reason to feel lucky to grow up in a city where we weren't so separate. Now, in 2016, being a Latin girl in hip-hop station is pretty common. If you'd let Salam Remy tell it, he says every one of those stations tried to put an Angie on the air, and that's why it's the norm now. When I need an ego boost, I let him tell it. But I will say, while touring for the album, I did meet all these different radio personalities around the country who would tell me, wow, I listen to your show. I tape your show. I got into radio because of you. It was super flattering and a surprise to get that type of love. So while the album itself met with mixed reviews, it was a big win in terms of strengthening my career as a radio personality. Everywhere I went, I got the message that my voice mattered to other people in the radio world. Amazing. At Hot 97, Tracy Cloherty, who was in charge at the time, made it possible for me to work only 4 days a week so I could tour with the album. That was unbelievable. Most radio stations don't support their talent that way. It's unheard of. I'd be on the radio Monday through Thursday, and then I'd fly out Thursday night to do shows on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And no matter where we were in the world, we had to get back on a plane Monday morning so I could be back on the air by 3 p.m. This was a new type of grind, even for me. But whatever. The last thing I was going to do was complain or slow down. This was my time to shine, right? So I just kept grinding. That is, until this one really late night in June when I was getting ready to head home after hosting a party at a club. And suddenly I felt like something was wrong. 2 days ago, I had begun shooting my video for Them Things. The label had only given us a budget for a one-day shoot, but trying to get the most of it, we were going to squeeze 2 days worth of video into a one-day shoot. That meant 4 wardrobe changes, 3 different locations, and 24 hours of nonstop shooting. After a day like that, the smart thing would have been to go home and collapse. Instead, after a Red Bull and a quick shower, I went straight to the Puerto Rican Day Parade. And that is not an event where you just call it in. The parade goes from 42nd to 82nd streets, and on every block, there's a new group of people. So you have to show each of them the love, screaming on the mic, waving the flag, performing and engaging the crowd. And this is June, and it's hot. But feeding off the energy of the people along the parade route, I'm running on adrenaline. So I keep going for hours. Everything culminated at 4, and then we went and grabbed something to eat. Me, Pecas, Yvette, DJ Enough, Monse, and a few other guys from the station. Only I wasn't really eating because I was taking some over-the-counter diet pills to keep my energy up and my appetite down. After that, around 7 o'clock, we headed to Carbon, where I was hosting the after party. When we showed up, I felt myself fading fast, and I said to Pecas, could you get me an apple martini, hoping it would put me in a more festive mood. 2 hours later, after just that one drink, we hopped in the SUV and started home. I began to feel queasy in the back seat, like I had too much to drink. Pecas pulled the car over. Huh? You didn't even drink that much. Peck, just pull the fucking car over. As he did, I opened the door and stuck my head out of the door as if I were going to vomit. That's the last thing I remember. When I opened my eyes, I was staring at a paramedic as I lay on the stretcher on the corner of 57th Street and 10th Avenue. He kept talking to me and asking me questions. I could hear him, but I couldn't muster the energy to speak back. He kept repeating, can you hear me? Did you take anything? All I could remember were these stupid diet pills. But I can't form the word Xenadrin. I could only say, it starts with an X. As the words were slurring out of my mouth, I realized how this was going to be misunderstood. Someone was going to think I had taken ecstasy, but I didn't have it in me to explain. And so I went back to sleep. When I woke up, I was in the emergency room with an IV pumping me full of fluids. Along with Pecas, the girls were all there, Nikki, Tracy, Liani, and my mom. It took me a half a day to convince my mother that I wasn't doing drugs. The doctors reassured her that there was nothing in my blood. I had just pushed my body to the absolute limit. To this day, my mother likes to remind me of that night whenever she sees me pushing myself too hard. Apparently, I was not invincible. Not that I believed in limiting myself, but clearly there was only so far you could push your body without putting something in the tank. Or as I started to say at the time, and still do, you have to respect the temple. Even if I'd wanted to keep up that pace, I knew that this had been a warning and had to decide what was really important to me. Being an artist and performer was something I loved doing, and I wanted to do it more and to grow. And in fact, pretty soon after that incident, a second album would be in the works. But the real question that I started to have was whether I had the same hunger to be famous that I saw in others who were. The truth is that deep down, I had this small fear of being too famous. Of course, I could appreciate the perks that come with fame, but there was a part of me that liked having my own normal life. A lot of people close to me by then had lived with fame 24/7, and they did not have normal lives. Around the same time, during that summer of 2001, when I was really trying to pull back and find more balance, everybody else in the hip-hop world was having a crazy year. Shine had been sentenced to 10 years in prison for a shooting at Club New York involving Puffy and J-Lo. At Summer Jam, Jay-Z debuted Takeover and dissed Prodigy by projecting a photo on the big screen of P as a kid in dance class. At the same time, he set off his beef with Nas. Ask Nas, he don't want to withhold, no. In fact, even before that, Jay had stopped by the station to play me the Blueprint album and get feedback before it dropped. There was no denying that this was Jay's best work to date. As much as I loved his first album, Reasonable Doubt, this album was more mature on every level. Lyrically, creatively, and from a production standpoint, it was just Jay at his finest. And then he played me Takeover. He saved it for last. For dramatic effect, I'm sure. Not that it needed it. And with no warning, he pressed play. Had a spark when you started, but now you're just garbage. Fell from top 10 and not mentioned at all. Are you talking about Nas? He smirked. And then the most disrespectful line of all. Cause you know who did you know what with you know who. Was he saying he had sex with Nas's girl? It sounded like it. Wow. Could Nas recover from this? On air and in the streets all summer long, I was getting an earful as all sorts of shit was brewing. And then all of a sudden, everything stopped. Chapter 10, Heart of the City. Ask anyone about the day before in New York and they'll usually talk about how normal everything was. That Monday night, my mother had stayed at my apartment in Hackensack, and she had just traveled back from Paris. That next morning, September 11th, we woke up and saw on TV that one of the two World Trade Center towers had been hit. Like everyone else watching that morning, we thought it was a terrible accident, that a plane had crashed into one of the towers. Then a short time later, when the second tower was hit, as we all watched in horror, it was beyond terrifying. What was happening? Immediately, I tried to call Nikki, who worked down there in the financial district, but I couldn't get her on the phone. Oh my God. Oh my God. Why doesn't she answer? Why can't I find Nikki? Many hours later, I would learn that Nikki was one of the people who had to walk over the Brooklyn Bridge to get out of there. But in the early hours of not knowing where she was and listening to the news coverage, I went into a full-blown panic attack. The terror that everyone felt watching it happen in real time was that you didn't know how far this was going to go. You didn't know if your building, the one you were sitting in, watching TV, was next. That all of a sudden the explosion was going to come through your window. You didn't know if you were going to be in a nuclear war. And then they said the Pentagon had got hit. And I just remember sitting there thinking, this could be it for all of us. So many years later, you hear all these different stories and everybody talks about the loss and the sadness and the devastation. Or they talk about how the city came together afterward. There are so many different perspectives about that tragic day. But we don't talk a lot about those moments of feeling like this could be it for everybody. I remember sitting there with my mother thinking, this could be it. Early that day, Q-Tip had called. We had broken up for almost 2 years by now, and our friendship was as strong as ever. Something was wrong with his TV, and he couldn't see what was going on, so he asked if he could come over with the girl he was dating at the time. Of course, it was okay. The four of us sat in front of my TV for hours, watching in horror. Even if I'd wanted to go to work that day, I couldn't. Everything was shut down. You couldn't move. The station was on air. Sonny Anderson had just started working with us and was at the station when it happened. and she just kind of stayed there. We also did a feed of the ABC news station as the emergency system started to kick in. So if you were a Hot 97 listener and you turned Hot 97 on, it sounded unfamiliar. Because either you would hear Sunny, who was an unfamiliar voice, or you would hear the feed of the news. Nothing made any sense. We were numb, we were scared, and we were all glued to the media. Phones, emails, TV, radio, as we tried to account for friends and relatives. Each time you breathed a sigh of relief that someone was okay and at home, you'd hear of someone else who had a loved one who was missing. I woke up on September 12th and thought, I can't go anywhere. I'd heard that you couldn't get into the city, especially downtown. The station was no longer in the Garment District, but had moved to a fancier building on Hudson Street, about 15 blocks away from Ground Zero. It was impossible to get there. That may have been true, but Tracy Cloherty had other thoughts when she called and said, you have to come to work today. I can't even get in the area. Angie, you have to figure it out. You have to get here. People need to hear you. Everybody is freaking out. Your listeners need to hear you. They can't turn on the radio and have it sound foreign. Everything is already foreign. They need to hear your voice today. And something about what she said hit me in my core. Got it. Oh my God, you're so right. I'm on my way. The least I could do was make the effort to be there. I didn't know how to handle anything like this. What do you say on the air? What are the guidelines? What's the protocol? I didn't know, but I knew that you just fucking show up. And so I did. Monse, the little brother of a friend I'd helped get hired at the station and had mentored, met me at 34th Street because every street below that was closed down. Monse was one of a handful of assistants I called my sons, in the loving sense of the word, not patronizing. He was always right there with me in the studio all night if that's what I needed. He always had my back and he had a bright future in radio. He gave me a hug and the two of us got going. But we were stopped right away by the cops on 34th and 5th Avenue. Look, the officer informed us. Nobody can get in from here. An emotional Monse spoke right up. Yo, that's Angie Martinez, he told the cops. She gotta talk to the people. We gotta be on the radio. So then we showed them our IDs and they let us through. And we started a long walk from 34th Street down to Houston Street. Walking downtown, we passed through throngs of people and everybody was just looking up. Those Learjets would pass overhead, but way too low. And each time, all of us just stopped and stared. Everybody was jumpy and scared. It was a terrifying sight you never wanted to see. You never wanted to experience. The soot, the smell, the smoke, and the horror. Everybody's face had fear on it. And you could see it. Everybody was walking around in shock. You had to show your ID not only to get past 34th, but also to get past 14th. Law enforcement had to be told where you were going and why you had to get down there. In fact, we had to show our FCC validation so that I could get down there. And they let us go. And the closer we walked, the closer we got to downtown, Houston Street, the stronger the smell. It was something you never forget. The smell of dead bodies. Inside the station, the mood was somber, and I went straight to the studio and got on the air. I opened the mic and took calls all day. People were talking, people were crying, and people asking other listeners to help find their loved ones. I let anybody get on that wanted to get on. I was glad this was something I could do and glad to just be there. Other than relay emergency information, there was nothing I could do to help anyone, really. But if being there made anyone at least feel a little bit normal, a little less alone, then that's what I would do. All of the other parts of life and career pale in moments of crisis when you're faced with a challenge you have no clue how you're supposed to handle. Unless you're trained for it, there's no right or wrong thing to do. You just have to show up. Face the moment head on, in a way that is real, and let the moment dictate what happens. There were other crises that I'd have to face, and all I could do was show up. To be able to have a platform and use my voice that week and for a while to come, that was a privilege for me. My job was not to know everything, only to share the mic and give others their voices too. What is it? What are we doing? I'm here, guys. What do you want to talk about? How do you feel? After I went off the air that day, instead of going home, I talked to Monse and my show producer, Patty Duke. The three of us decided to walk farther downtown together, as far as we could go. We wanted to feel it. Walls of buildings and barricades were plastered with missing people posters. We stopped at the firehouse and looked at all the posters there. There was so much sadness. People's faces and the smell and the soot and the loss. The stories of that day are endless. It was as if the whole city had suffered a death in the family. Whether you know someone who died that day or not, everyone felt the pain. For months after that, driving down the West Side Highway on my way to work every day, it was amazing to see that day after day, people continued to line up on the sides of the streets, applauding every time a police car or a fire truck passed by heading down to the World Trade Center. Every day, the good people of New York came out in any weather to stand there, cheering and holding signs that said, "Thank you." Thank you to the police, the firefighters, the EMTs. Thank you. Part 3, Beyond Radio, 2001 to 2014. Chapter 11, Ether. When I think back to 2002 and everything that had happened in our culture and media, my head fills with competing voices. These were noisy times. Technology was dramatically changing the music business. Even though Napster was found guilty for illegal use of file sharing technology, the possibility that consumers could get their music for free and online was out there, and the industry was starting to panic. On top of that, while Twitter and Instagram were nowhere in sight, this was the beginning of social media sites like Black Planet and Mi Gente, which let users connect and share information without needing the radio. They were the precursors to sites like MySpace, where emerging artists could showcase their music without radio or record labels. This was also the year that American Idol debuted, with Kelly Clarkson as the first winner. So now radio's job of breaking new artists was being shared with network television, and they had the power to engage millions of viewers to call in and vote. Nobody knew where any of this was going, but those of us paying attention were very aware of the fact that we'd no longer be the only source for immediate information, no longer the only place you could hear your favorite hip-hop artist be interviewed. Now the artists would have a platform where they could speak directly to their audience. So neither would need us in the same way they always had. The writing was on the wall. To stay afloat, you'd have to make noise. Entertainment in general had become noisy. Everything was epic, like the big movies of the year, Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, Star Wars, and Men in Black 2. The same was happening in hip-hop. Eminem, Missy, and Nelly all dropped huge albums that year. Eminem even went platinum in his first week, beating Snoop's record for albums sold by a solo artist in 1 week. In that noisy competitive atmosphere, a new battle was getting underway, in my business, and few people really understood the implications. The moment happened on March 14, 2002, when Jammin' 105, the oldie station down the dial, changed formats. Power 105.1 was born. There was another hip-hop station in town, and the game was about to change. Up until that point at Hot, we had always been able to do what we wanted. There had never been any competition. Since 1994, we'd been the only hip-hop station in the city. All of a sudden, that would no longer be the case. What pissed me off about Power coming was not the threat of competition, but the belief